Welcome, and good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. I just wanted to officially welcome you to today's CLUIN Internet Seminar on Stable Isotope Analyses to Understand the Degradation of Organic Contaminants in Groundwater. Again, this is part one of a two-part series. This particular seminar has been sponsored by my office here at the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. And I work in that same group. My name is Jean Valance, and I will be serving as the moderator for today's event. Again, we're going to officially kick off the presentation with John Wilson here from the EPA, but we're going to go over some basic housekeeping items to let a few latecomers get themselves situated and ready to begin the presentation. Just a reminder, you should have the PowerPoint or presentation materials open in front of you. There's a few ways you can access them. When you registered, you would have been given a confirmation email, which would have had a seminar homepage or URL where you could access the slides. You can either download them as either a PowerPoint or PDF, or you could actually be looking at them through a web browser window, whatever format makes the most sense to you. So if you have done so, everyone should be looking at the very first slide, which is our title slide. Just a reminder, on that seminar homepage, there was a complete description.
I don't know what the volume is on here. It doesn't have anything that says volume.
And those of you who are talking about the volume of your phone, please hit mute. You want to hit star 6 right now so we don't hear any more of that conversation. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Again, this session is a two-part series. This is the first part. If you want to read the full description as well as look at a previous delivery of this session or take a look at the upcoming or part two, which is going to happen later on this month, you'll want to refer back to that seminar homepage. You'll also find contact information for myself as well as today's presenter. So if at any point in time you'd like to follow up with other comments or questions, you're welcome to refer back to that homepage to look up our contact information. A reminder, I hear lots of beeps. I know people are still joining us on the phone lines. If you are on the phones, please, please do me a big favor and hit the mute button right now or simply hit star 6 to keep your phone on mute. That will really help cut back on disruptions, which could interfere with the quality of our presentation today. Again, star 6 to mute your line. At the appropriate times, when we have a chance to ask questions and interact with our instructor today, I'll remind everyone how to take themselves off of mute. You can either unmute or hit pound 6 at that time. But until then, again, do me a big favor and hit star 6 to keep your phone on mute. Do not put the call on hold either. Sometimes there's background music or commercials that could be disruptive to our presentation today. So simply hit star 6 and place yourselves on mute. Those of you who are streaming the audio, we don't have to worry about that. You guys can't talk to us. But I want to direct everyone to move along to slide number 2. Again, with all CLUIN seminars, each participant is required to manually move themselves through the materials and verbal cues. If you have the slides printed in front of you, simply turn the page. If you are looking at the slides online, you'll notice a couple of colored icons on the top of your screen. You can use one of those arrows, the single arrow pointing to the right to move or advance to the next slide, or the single arrow pointing to the left to move backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the left side to jump to any numbered slide at any time. Again, a reminder, please keep this phone call on mute. I can hear phones being moved around and conversations. If I don't have this cleared up, I'm going to globally mute everybody. So star 6, please. Thank you. The other thing to point out for those of you that are streaming the audio, there is a question mark icon located at the top of your slides. And if you have your pop-up blocker disabled, if you click on that, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up a comment or question that I will read on your behalf to the instructor when we get to that point in time. You don't have to wait to Q&A breaks or till the end of the presentation to do that. You can type up those comments or questions as soon as they occur to you. Just be sure, again, to have your pop-up blocker disabled. Also, you can use that very same form to report any technical difficulties. So if you can't see something or you're having difficulties hearing the instructor, please feel free to do so to report that to me so we can work with you. If you do have technical problems, please be sure to give us a phone number where we can reach you to try to troubleshoot whatever issues may be. Again, our instructor will be indicating, and I can hear somebody speaking. If you said okay, whoever's speaking right now, I can hear you. Please hit star 6 to mute your line. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. This instructor will be indicating as he moves through the material, so you'll be required to manually move yourself or advance through the slides. There will be time for Q&A. I'll provide instructions for those of you on the phone line to take yourself off of mute to verbally ask those questions. Those of you online streaming the audio, type up those comments, and I'll read them on your behalf at the appropriate time. A couple of final reminders as well. We are recording this entire session, and it will be available for a free replay in approximately 2 weeks on the CLUIN training page. You can follow the link to our archive seminars there. We will also, when we close out today's presentation, point you to two important resources. The first is an additional links or additional resources page, which has not only today's presentation materials, but a variety of other websites and resources that have been pulled together by the organizers relevant to today's talk. The other link we're going to point you to is a feedback form. Please just take a minute or two to let us know what you thought of today's presentation. If you'd like to continue to participate in free online technical training, definitely take a minute or two to fill out that feedback form. I do read each and every one of those submissions, so I thank you in advance for that. Those of you looking to receive credit for today's course, if you're trying to collect CEUs or PDHs, we don't officially offer those, but sometimes the accrediting organization that you're meeting training requirements for may accept a copy of the materials as well as a registration confirmation to verify that you participated. If you fill out the feedback form, there's an option to have a confirmation email sent to you for your records. So you want to be sure to do so and just take a minute to do the feedback form for your own confirmation message. I think that is the end of my housekeeping items. And I'm going to turn things over to our instructor today. So with that, I'm going to direct everybody to move on to the third slide, which is the official title slide for today's presentation. Our speaker today is John Wilson, who is a research microbiologist for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He has a B.S. in biology from Baylor University, an M.A. in microbiology from the University of California at Berkeley, and a Ph.D. in microbiology from Cornell University. He has worked at the RS CARE Environmental Research Center in Ada, Oklahoma since 1978. Currently, he's conducting research on in-situ bioremediation of chlorinated solvents and on natural attenuation of BTEX compounds, fuel additives, and chlorinated solvents. In addition to this and his research activities, John provides training and technical assistance to the EPA regions and to state agencies on natural attenuation of chlorinated solvents, fuel additives, and BTEX compounds in groundwater. So I'd like to welcome John, and go ahead, I'll turn things over to you on slide number 3.
Welcome to our webinar. Today we're going to talk about some applications of compound isotope analysis. Next week we'll talk about some of the quality issues and some recommendations for scopes of work and contracts to get quality data to submit to regulatory agencies. And then next month, we're going to bring in some other experts with deep experience to present an advanced course. That advanced course will be Wednesday, October 27. So right now, we're going to do an introduction with an emphasis on applications. Slide 4. This is focused on volatile organic contaminants that are regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. These compounds are composed of carbon, hydrogen, and chlorine. Each of these three elements have isotopes of that particular element. These are stable isotopes. They're not radioactive. And they differ from each other basically in the number of neutrons in the nucleus. And that means that they can be separated and quantified based on their mass. Let's go to slide 6. As these compounds are degraded in the environment, the ratio of the stable isotopes in the material that remains behind may change in a predictable way. When that happens, it allows us to put an unambiguous conservative boundary on the extent of biodegradation or abiotic transformation of the organic compounds in groundwater. In a way, what we're doing is using the compound itself as a tracer. So it's a powerful technique to recognize degradation that's already occurred in the environmental system under study. Go to slide 7. My particular interest in many of the applications for compound-specific isotope analysis are directed toward understanding natural attenuation processes. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's expectations for the appropriate implementation of M&A is described and codified in the OSWER Directive 9200.4-17P, also sometimes called OSWER 1999. This is EPA's formal guidance on expectations for M&A, and in the guidance, and these are pretty much quotes from that guidance, this EPA considers M&A to be an appropriate remedial approach when it can be demonstrated that it will achieve our cleanup objectives within a reasonable time frame. Now, within a reasonable time frame means that we have to put a rate constant on the rate of cleanup. It's not enough simply to know that it's cleaning up. We need to know how fast it's cleaning up so that we can determine if it's going to get where we want to be by the time we expect to be there. This has been one of the major problems with monitored natural attenuation in the past. Before the availability of CSIA, we really didn't have good tools to allow us to determine how fast these compounds were cleaning up under natural conditions. Let's go to slide 8. The OSRA directive accepts three different kinds of information or data. The information that EPA likes to see the best or the most is basically historical monitoring data on concentrations or quantities of compounds that demonstrate a trend of declining concentration over time. At many sites, this is supplemented and supported by other data, puts the trend data into a hydrogeological and geochemical context that allows us to determine the particular process that's responsible for the attenuation concentrations and gives further confirmation of the rates of attenuation. And then finally, at problematic sites or sites where there's little technical background, we like to see supporting information, and the OSRA directive is a little over 10 years old now. Microcosm studies or other field studies that demonstrate the currents and document the particular attenuation process. What's the biogeochemical process that's actually destroying the materials and documenting the ability of that process to degrade the contaminants of concern? Number 3 has been hard to get, and it's been rarely presented to the agency because the traditional approaches are too expensive, and they take too long to produce usable data. Let's go to slide 9. Compound-specific isotope analysis can provide that third line of evidence at low cost and with a short turnaround time. In appropriate circumstances, and appropriate really refers to the conditions that pertain at the particular field site that's being characterized, CSIA also can be used to identify the mechanisms and provide an estimate of the rate of degradation. CSIA can provide a substantial increase in our ability to technically characterize the rates and the processes of degradation of contaminants in groundwater. Let's go to slide 10. I told you that most of the compounds that we're concerned about in groundwater are made up of hydrogen, carbon, and chlorine. The stable isotopes commonly evaluated are isotopes of hydrogen, carbon, and chlorine, primarily hydrogen 2 compared to hydrogen 1. Hydrogen 2 is also often called deuterium. The symbol is a capital D. For the carbon isotopes, usually we're comparing carbon 13 to carbon 12, and for chlorine, we're comparing carbon 37 to carbon 35. So if we have a device that can measure the ratio of these isotopes and molecules that are present in groundwater samples at low concentration, then we have a mechanism that we can use to document biodegradation or abiotic transformation processes. Let's go to slide 11. The machine that actually does that determination is called an isotope ratio mass spectrometer. They're still not super common, but there are now hundreds of them available worldwide. The machine does not actually measure directly the ratio of the stable isotope ratios in the sample. For example, if we were looking at carbon, it doesn't measure the ratio of carbon 13 to carbon 12. What it measures is the ratio of carbon 13 to carbon 12 in a sample against that ratio in a reference standard. So it's measuring a ratio against a ratio. For that reason, the units for the expressed changes in the ratios are a little unfamiliar. Let's go to slide 12. We're looking at a change in a ratio, so the symbol for that is delta. And if we're looking at the ratio of 13C to 12C, then that would be called delta 13C. And it's usually expressed not directly, but in terms of parts per thousand. And when that's the case, you'll see a per mil sign associated with the number. Let's go to slide 13. There is an error here. There should be a per mil sign after the delta 13C. But delta 13C per mil then is simply the ratio in the sample divided by the ratio in the standard minus 1, and then that normalized ratio multiplied by 1,000. That's the unit that is usually reported by the analyst back to the consulting engineer or the regulator that's interested in the number. Slide 14. Now, the reason that these values for delta 13C are useful or usable is that molecules that contain a 13C carbon are metabolized at a slower rate than molecules that are only comprised of carbon 12. The molecule is a little bit heavier, doesn't have quite as much kinetic energy at a given temperature, it's less likely to exceed a Boltzmann threshold, it's less likely to participate in enzymic processes. The result of that is it tends to stay behind and become enriched in the residual compound that has not yet been processed by the particular degradation process we're interested in. So the more degradation that we have, the greater the ratio of carbon 13 to carbon 12. Let's go to slide 15. So we can use this change in ratios to extract two useful pieces of information. The first, most direct, and often most useful thing is to establish that degradation is happening. We simply do this by comparing the carbon isotope ratio, or the hydrogen isotope ratio, or the chlorine isotope ratios to the material as we find it in the groundwater against the ratio that would pertain to the material that was originally released. Now, if the ratios are different, particularly if they're different in the right direction, that we're accumulating the heavy isotope, then that's evidence that degradation is an ongoing process. Sometimes we can actually use the difference in the ratios to estimate an extent of degradation, and then from the extent of degradation, estimate a rate constant. That rate constant then is particularly useful in transported fate models to forecast the future behavior of the contaminant. Going to slide 16. I'm going to illustrate that process that I've just described in words for those of you that, like me, that are visual thinkers. We're going to do a thought experiment where we're going to enrich dots as the dots are degraded. And in our thought experiment, the black dots are going to be removed at a rate that's only 75% of the rate of removal of the white dots. So going to slide 17, we're going to start off with a situation where the original ratio of black to white dots is 1:9. And if the rate of removal of black dots is only 75% of the rate of removal of white dots, after half of all the dots are degraded, then the ratio of black to white dots is 1:6. And after 3/4 of all the dots are degraded, the ratio is now 1:4. And after 7/8 of all the dots are remediated, the ratio is now 1:3. So you can see that as the quantity of dots goes down, the ratio of black dots to white dots goes up. And that's really all we're doing when we're comparing the ratio of the stable isotopes. We're making the same comparison. Let's go to slide 18. So if you know an enrichment factor, in other words, that ratio of relative removal of the black dots to the white dots, or carbon 13 to carbon 12, or hydrogen 2 to hydrogen 1, or chlorine 37 to chlorine 35, you can tell how much material had been degraded or removed at the time that you collected that particular sample. Let's go to slide 19. So what is that quantitative relationship between the changes in the ratio of the stable isotopes and the extent of degradation? Probably most of the work in this area has been done for MTBE. Certainly it's one of the better understood compounds, and it tends to be reactive and well behaved, so I'm going to use it as an illustration, but the behavior of MTB applies widely to a variety of other organic contaminants in groundwater. So let's go to slide 20. First thing we need to know is that ratio of stable isotopes in the material that we begin with. Sometimes we know that, most of the time we don't. Many people will make the simplifying assumption that it is probably constrained within the ratio of the stable isotopes in that material that was in commerce. So the people in the reference that I provided in slide 20 got samples of gasoline from all over the world and measured the stable isotope ratio for carbon in those gasoline samples. They found that it ranged from a value of minus 28 per mil to minus 33 per mil. The numbers are negative because the material has less carbon than does the standard it was used to standardize the ratios. Let's go to slide 21. So this is a chart that predicts the changes in the ratio in the thought experiment. We actually know from laboratory experimentation the change in the ratios under anaerobic degradation processes and aerobic degradation processes. And what I've done is summarized a lot of experiments into one sort of summary rate constant. So along the x-axis, you have a log scale for the fraction remaining. First tick mark, 90% of the MTB is degraded. The next tick mark, 99% is degraded. The next tick mark, 99.9% is degraded. As the MTB is degraded, it becomes heavier. The material that remains behind becomes heavier. That is to say, it's got more 13C and less 12C. And that heaviness is expressed then in the delta 13C per mil. And so it starts off at about minus 13 in gasoline and commerce. And under anaerobic degradation conditions, by the time 90% of it's degraded, then it's up around minus 6 per mil. By the time 99% is degraded, it's up around 20 per mil. By the time 99.9% is degraded, it's up around 45 per mil. So if we know the ratio in the material in the groundwater, we can use these relationships and estimate the fraction that is remaining of the original material that was released to the groundwater system. This is the same figure, except that I've expressed the extended degradation as the natural logarithm of the fraction remaining instead of just simply plotting the numbers. If you do a regression of the delta 13C as the independent variable, the Y value, on the natural logarithm of the fraction remaining as the X variable, the slope of the line is a description of the proclivity or susceptibility changes in delta 13C during degradation. The negative the number, the greater the change in delta 13C for a given extent of degradation. So that you can see for aerobic degradation, that number is minus 2.3 per mil. For anaerobic degradation, that number is minus 11.6 per mil. Now those rate constants, those slopes of the line, those rate factors, and they can actually be used to predict the extent of degradation. Let's go to slide 23. Using this formula, the fraction remaining, F, if you're a geochemist or a biologist, or C over C naught, if you're an engineer, then simply is E, the base of the natural logs, to an exponent. That exponent is the delta 13C of the MTBE or whatever else in the groundwater that's sampled, minus the delta 13C that you would expect. The material that was originally, that divided by that enrichment factor, epsilon.
I'm just going to interrupt you, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to globally mute all of the phone lines. I can hear something moving. When I do that, everyone's going to hear a message that I've globally muted, and then, John, I'm going to ask you to hit #6 after you hear that global mute message so you can continue talking. I apologize for the interruption.
The leader has muted your line.
And again, John, all you'll need to do is hit #6, and you can continue speaking. Again, John, you want to hit #6. We still, we're waiting for John to hit #6 so he can continue speaking.
John's back, I hope.
Well, fabulous, you are. Thank you so very much. Go ahead, carry on.
All right, this relationship is called the Rayleigh relationship or Rayleigh expression. Most of the time, it can be used as an approximation. When it's applied to real systems, there's always complexity. It probably ought to be one of the fundamental laws of the universe. But it makes a good starting point in understanding the interaction between isotopic fractionation and the changes in concentration. So it can be used, but I'm going to give you a reference that gives you some of the caveats and concerns that might be used and need to be investigated before you use it uncritically. Let's go to slide 24. So if you know the delta 13C, that's on the x-axis, then you can back predict from that equation the fraction of MTBE that would be remaining in the water that you sampled. And there's two lines there that express the range of delta 13C that's in MTBE in gasoline and commerce. So for a given delta 13C, you can see that there's a range of possible fractions remaining that would be predicted. For example, for a value of delta 13C of 0, it could either be 0.9 remaining or something in the neighborhood of about 0.06 remaining. Next slide. So what I'm going to do is take the more conservative estimate, the one that predicts the least degradation or the greater fraction remaining as I go forward in my analysis of a data set from a real site. Let's go to slide 26. So we're going to see if we can use this to understand a plume of MTBE from a motor fuel spill from an underground storage tank. Slide 27. Remember, the Oxford Directive wants us to be able to demonstrate M&A processes and rates. Let's go to slide 28. The case study is documented in more detail in the following EPA report. If you're interested in the details or you want to go into further depth in some of the logic, I invite your attention to this particular document. Slide 29. That's one place to find it. I think that it's also one of the materials that's on the CLUIN webpage as additional materials. Slide 30. Slide 31. Or if you just simply take the name of the document and go into Google, it'll pop up. So there's three different ways that you can find this document. Probably want to start with the CLUIN webpage, and that gives me some idea of how many of you actually took advantage of having the EPA report available to you. Let's go to slide 32. So here's our site. It's a conventional corner gasoline mom and pop station spill. The arrow rows in the left-hand side of the figure is the direction of groundwater flow that was determined by putting a plane through the water table elevation of water in the monitoring wells at the site. So that's where groundwater is moving. The length of the arrow is how far groundwater would move in 1 year under the hydraulic gradient that pertained at one particular round of monitoring. So that you can see for these, let's see, there's eight separate rounds of monitoring. The groundwater flow direction changes a little bit, but it's pretty generally to the west. And the groundwater flow velocity changes a little bit, but it's generally on the scale of about 40 meters per year. So that's where the groundwater is moving at this site. The solid and dotted orb is the footprint occupied by the residual gasoline from the spill. Individual dots are monitoring wells. The monitoring wells are named. And then there's a number that identifies the concentration of MTBE in that monitoring well for samples collected in 2004. I'll also show you where the original underground storage tanks were and where the dispenser island for the dispensers were, and still are for that matter, at this site. So this is a site where we're going to try to understand the attenuation of MTBE. You'll notice that the most contaminated well, MW14, in the very center of the figure, had 26,000 micrograms per liter MTBE, and within approximately 60 meters flow, that well, MW11, in the upper corner of the figure, concentrations went down to 318 micrograms per liter. Now let's go to slide 33. This is a geological cross-section along the direction of flow going from above the tank removal through where the tank fill was and then down gradient. You can see that when they did the tank removal, unfortunately, they left some TPH behind. They got most of it, but they left enough TPH that it continued to form a plume of MTBE in water. Next slide. And let's skip that slide. Let's go to 35. We're going to look at degradation of MTBE at this site two different ways. The first degradation product of MTBE is tertiary butyl alcohol, TBA. As the little structural figures below show that. TBA is also a minor component of the technical grade of MTBE that was used in gasoline. But usually if there's enough degradation, we can actually use the accumulation of TBA over time as an indication of the biodegradation of MTBE. So we're going to look at the ratio and concentrations of TBA to MTBE, as well as the change in the stable isotope ratio of the MTBE itself. Next slide. We have data available on stable isotope ratios, and we're going to use this little nomograph that I showed you to turn the delta 13 C's into a prediction of the fraction of MTBE that was remaining from the MTBE that was originally spilled to that particular flow path to that particular monitoring well. Slide 37. So you see MW14 in the center of the figure. That's the most contaminated well. At the time these data were collected, 26,000 micrograms per liter MTBE. Let's take a look then at monitoring well 8, monitoring well 3, and monitoring well 6, which are downgradient generally of the spill. You'll notice that monitoring well 6 is really not downgradient of monitoring well 14. It's downgradient of a second release associated with the dispenser island. So in monitoring well 8, MTBE is much lower in concentration. It goes from 26,000 in monitoring well 14 down to 14 micrograms per liter. And the TBA goes up to 30,000 micrograms per liter. So we've got basically a replacement of the MTBE with TBA. And our stable isotope analysis predicts that 99.94% of the MTBE was degraded. And so the stable isotope analysis is confirming what we're seeing in terms of the ratio of the original compound and its daughter. We're also seeing extensive degradation of MTBE in monitoring well 3 and extensive degradation of MTBE in monitoring well 6. So the isotope ratios are telling us that those low MTBE concentrations are not flukes. The bugs have been after it. Next slide, slide 38. There are two wells downgradient, however, that follow exactly the opposite pattern. We've got a fair amount of MTBE and lower concentrations of TBA. This is particularly true for monitoring well 11, the well furthest downgradient. And the stable isotope ratio predicts that there is no degradation. In well monitoring 7, that's intermediate between MW11 and MW14, we do have some degradation of MTB to TBA based on ratios, but the isotopic fractionation indicates that there's relatively little degradation. So what we see, and this is something that's very commonly seen in field scale if you take enough samples, is that the response and the behavior of the site is heterogeneous. Let's go to slide 38. In some wells, the MTB degrades, and degrades extensively. In other wells, it doesn't degrade. We very commonly see for fuel spills that the degradation often is associated with the higher concentrations in the interior of the plume, and this absence of degradation is usually associated with lower concentrations at the fringe or the periphery of the plume. Let's go to slide 40. So I am going to offer an approach to deal with this heterogeneity. As our first step, we're going to determine if the biodegradation is stable over time so that we can project that behavior forward in time in a risk evaluation. So go to slide 41. So we went back to our site a little over a year later, and we took samples from the same wells. And so here for MW14, the most contaminated well, and MW3 and MW8, which are down gradient of that most contaminated well, concentrations of TBA and MTB that are measured, the delta 13C for the MTBE, you can see as you go from MW14 to 3 to 8, the MTB becomes significantly heavier, the delta 13 is Delta 13C is significantly less negative, and that the fraction of MTB remaining goes down. And most importantly, between 2003 and 2004, whatever was happening there happened to a greater extent. The MTB was heavier, and the fraction of MTB remaining was less than the situation 1 year before. So we have some justification and extrapolating this behavior forward into time. Next slide is just a duplicate of 41, so let's go to slide 43. So we're going to try to put that into a hydrogeological context. We have data for slug testing on the wells to estimate an average hydraulic conductivity. I showed you those flow arrows. Those were actually picked from estimates of hydraulic gradient. And I'm going to assume an effective porosity of 0.25, which is an assumption. I've got no justification for it other than that's a good average value. And you put all three of those together, and that will will calculate an average seepage velocity using Darcy's law of about 37 to 40 meters per year. So that's how fast the groundwater is moving. Slide 44. Now let's skip this slide and go to slide 45. So we have information on how MTB is degrading as it moves from the conditions that pertain at MW14 to conditions that pertain at MW8 or the conditions that pertain at MW3. Let's go to slide 46. So for MW3 and MW8, for those two dates, 2003 and 2004, we've used our delta 13C data to estimate fractions remaining. We know the distance between the two wells in meters, and so I'm going to plug the fraction remaining and the distance into that formula that you see. The formula is the rate of degradation is equal to the natural log of the fraction remaining divided by the distance. If you solve the formula, then for MW8 in 2004, the projected rate of biodegradation per meter of travel is 0.46. First order rate constant for degradation with distance of travel along the flow path. Most people are a little uncomfortable with that. I'm going to turn it into a rate constant with time, In the next slide, that's slide 47. And so we've got fraction remaining, distance between the wells, and I'm going to multiply the 0.46 per meter by the flow rate of water, 37 meters per year, to get a projected rate of biodegradation in units of time of 17 per year. Now, some people are a little uncomfortable with the first order rate constant. You could think of that as 1,700% per year. In other words, it's really, really fast. It's turning over pretty good. That's a half-life of a couple of weeks. Let's go to slide 48. I'm going through the same calculations for the flow path between the Dispenser Island and MW6. So I take the fraction remaining, the distance between the Dispenser, well, actually I've done it from MW14, sorry, MW6 to 14, projected a rate of biodegradation in time per years, and that comes out to be a slightly slower rate. Actually, this, I have an error here, and it's in the labeling the figure. It's not the distance from MW14. What I really did do was calculate it for the distance from the Dispenser Island to that particular well. So the numbers are right, it's just that the distance is mislabeled. So I took the distance from the inferred source, the secondary release at the Dispenser Island, to particular monitoring well 6. That's 31 meters. And I used that information, the flow velocity and the fraction remaining, to calculate a rate constant of about 2 to 3 per year. Let's go to slide 49. All right, so what I told you is it degrades in the green and it's not degrading in the brown. Next slide. Skip this slide. Let's go to slide 51. Slide MW7 and MW11 are in the brown. These are the wells where it's not degrading. I gave you information on the TBA that's measured, the MTB that's measured, the delta 13C of the MTBE, the estimated fraction remaining. The stable isotope analysis says nothing's happening, at least biologically. The concentrations are low, and it kind of presses the limits of the technology, so the delta 13Cs are a little bit noisy. But still, the conclusion from the noisy data, the uncertain data, is still, there's not any evidence that MTB is degrading. In fact, the delta 13C downgradient is actually slightly more negative, less heavy, less fractionated, than our assumed range for MTBE in commerce. So we have no evidence for these wells, MW7 or MW11, that MTB is degrading using our stable isotope analysis. Let's go to slide 52. So we turn that into a rate constant and see there hardly anything at all or nothing. In other words, certainly nothing useful and nothing. So for those wells, the best assumption is to assume when we do our transport and fate model as part of our risk evaluation is that there's no biodegradation in the flow pass down gradient of those wells. Go to slide 53. I want to take a sidebar real quick and justify those rate constants. We've done laboratory microcosm studies where we take core samples from the sites and we put them in little glass bottles, incubate them at the laboratory, spike it up with known concentrations of MTBE and watch the MTBE go away under anaerobic conditions through anaerobic biodegradation. Slide 54, let's go to slide 55. So this is a laboratory study that was done at a site that's literally just down the road from the site where I showed you the field data. So we added a little over 1,000 micrograms per liter to our microcosms. In 60 days, we're down a little above 100 micrograms per liter. If we fit a rate constant to the decline in concentration, that comes out to 32 per year, which is reasonable. a little bit faster, in fact, than the rate that we got at field scale. So though those field scale rates are fast, they're plausible based on this independent laboratory microcosm evaluation. You'll often hear that rates of anaerobic degradation are slow. Well, many times they are. But for MTBE, under the right circumstances, the rates can actually be very fast. Let's go to slide 56. So, back on our main logic, this is our process to evaluate heterogeneity. We've determined that biodegradation, when it occurs, was stable over time. Our next step is to determine how far the contaminant would extend from the core of the plume if the concentrations of the contaminant were controlled by biodegradation. So, slide 57. Slide 58. We're going to use a model, an EPA screening model, that is available to you at no cost from EPA web pages. I give you the web address here. It's basically just a super macro written in Excel. It's very easy to learn. It's very easy to use. It was designed for chlorinated solvents. The model doesn't know we're going to use it for MTBE, but it has some advantages over some of the older screening models like BioScreen. So we're going to use the BioChlor 2.2 model to project the future behavior of this MTBE plume. Let's go to slide 59. That's the input screen for the model. We're going to assume that our source starts at a concentration of 26,000 micrograms per liter, that our rate of biodegradation is 10 per year, first order rate constant. And for the sake of illustration, I'm going to assume that there's a receptor of concern at 1,000 feet from the edge of the L-NAPLE, or the center of the L-NAPLE. And so in our hypothetical risk evaluation, the question is that going to plume get is going to get out there and cause us problems 1,000 feet down gradient? Now, you may or may not be able to read the input values on that menu. That's not important. I've blown up the ones that are really important in the next slides. So let's go to slide 60. The model is designed to evaluate retardation due to sorption. I've turned that off. I've entered a value of 1 for the retardation coefficient so that sorption and retardation disappear from the behavior of the contaminant. So that's the first black arrow. The second black arrow shows that I put in a rate constant of 10 per year for the initial transformation of MTB to TBA. Let's go to slide 61. And so at the beginning of the model, at a distance of 0 from the hot spot, then I tell it that the concentration of MTB is 26 milligrams per liter. Those other numbers and those other distances are the concentrations of MTBE in wells, various distances down gradient of MW14. Let's go to slide 62. And so basically, those are the wells that were used to calibrate the BioChlor model. The red dots that are enclosed in the dotted ellipse. So distances are measured from MW14 to MW3, 8, 7, 16, and 11. Let's go to slide 63. So this is the output of our screening model. Assuming that the rate of degradation is 10 per year, that's the blue line. We have concentrations of MTBE on a log scale on the y-axis. And the state of California is happy if we can get it down below about 0.008 per milligram per liter. And so that's where the blue arrow is pointing. The range of acceptable values actually is about 0.014 to 0.008. And it says that we get to the acceptance level for MTBE in about 300 feet of travel. You'll notice in the black squares with the yellow cross in it, the real data, is that all of the data fall on or below that projected line. In other words, the removals that we saw at field scale were at least equivalent to or greater than the removal that would have been projected by the model using rate constants that were extracted from the stable isotope analyses. So the stable isotope analysis really is conservative. The field scale removals are greater than what the model said we would deserve from the rate constants that were calculated using CSI data. Let's go to slide 64. What would happen if there's no degradation? Well, that's the red line. And by the time we get to our receptor at 1,000 feet, we're not even close. We're only down to about 10 milligrams per liter. Let's go to slide 65. So what this tells us is that the risk to the receptor is really controlled by the conditions at MW11 and the behavior of the material at MW11. We've got a fair amount of MTB in the water. Maybe, that'd be 1% of the concentration at MW14, but that 1% is not degrading. So what does that mean in terms of our risk evaluation? Let's go to slide 66. So our final step is to determine the extent of that periphery of the plume where there's no biodegradation of the contaminant. Notice slide 67, 68. Slide 68, then, I'm going to recalibrate BioChlor. And so now the concentration of the source is now MW11, is 0.318 milligrams per liter. The model will not let me turn biodegradation off, but it will let me turn it down so much that it's trivial and you can't see an effect. And so that's what I've done. So I've entered a very low number for the rate of biodegradation, and we're closer to our receptor, so the distance along the flow path to the point of concern now is only 860 feet. Let's go to the next slide. Go to the next slide. We're at slide 70. That just shows how I've calibrated it. I put in the MTB concentration of 0.318 milligram per liter, and I put in a low value for the lambda for the first zone of biotransformation. Let's go to slide 71. That's what we get. It turns out that for our estimated values of dispersion, that it gets real close. In other words, I kind of fudged it to where it's right on top of the upper acceptance level in the state of California. I did this on purpose to illustrate the point that you never want to trust a little simple screening model to make an important regulatory decision. So if you see something like this where it's not clear cut and you don't have orders of magnitude of difference between what you project and what you want, you need more information. You need more wells, and you need more documentation. So in this particular case, I would say there's a very good chance that natural attenuation will protect the receptor, but the information that I have on hand doesn't really prove it. And that this particular case study would be a situation where you would need and expect to collect more information before you were really comfortable in making a decision one way or the other. Let's go to slide 72. I just want to re-emphasize that the approach with the stable isotope ratios was conservative because the real attenuation at field scale is greater than that it was predicted by the rate constant extracted using the Delta 13C data and the little screening model. Let's go to slide 73. This is usually the case. You'll usually underestimate the rate and extent of degradation. There's two interactions that cause that. One is that you have heterogeneity and flow paths that tend to predict mixed samples that kind of dilute out the fractionation in the degraded flow paths. And the other is that the flow paths that are in proximity to the NAPA will continue to recruit new unfractionated contaminant into the flow path while some of the material is already being degraded. And so you don't really start at a clean start. You tend to get more unfractionated material to replace the material that's been degraded. And so the total delta-13C of the material in bulk is less fractionated than would be expected from the extent of degradation that's actually really happened. These two interactions combine, and the usual interaction, the usual result of that is the delta-13Cs are going to underestimate almost always the true removal that you see at field scale. Slide 74. What slide 74 says is basically in words what I just went over with you, so I'm not going to read it to you again. Let's go to slide 75. Let's go to slide 76. So I'm back to the OSWR directive and what it expects. One of the things that's required of that third line of evidence is actually to be able to identify the attenuation process that's acting. The agency likes to know what's really causing the reduction in contamination. The reason for that is the agency prefers destruction mechanisms to mechanisms that simply dilute the contamination, like dispersion or absorption. So let's go to slide 77. Sometimes if you do compound-specific isotope analysis for two elements on the same compound at the same time, we call this two-dimensional CSIR, CSIA. Or with the recent advent of chlorine, sometimes three-dimensional CSIA, then that will allow you to discriminate between the mechanisms. Let's go to slide 78. This is best illustrated for the situation with MTBE. We know of three different biological degradation mechanisms for MTBE. An aerobic degradation mechanism that uses an oxygenase to start the process. An aerobic degradation mechanism that starts through an ether hydrolysis process. And then the anaerobic degradation process that I've been talking about. And you'll see that the fractionation factors for hydrogen and carbon, for carbon, are, let's go to slide 79. The slides got a little bit jumbled. While we're looking at the first column where it says 2.4 and 0.48 and 13, that's the fractionation for carbon. The second column where it says 30 and 0.2 and 16, that's the fractionation for hydrogen. And so because you have two different fractionations, you can create a space. You can map out the two and project where you would expect the combined delta 13C and delta hydrogen, delta 2 hydrogen to be, and compare and see if you fall into that space. Let's go to slide 80. And that's a reference where a particular research group at the University of Oklahoma was able to use two-dimensional CSIA to figure out interphase transfer phenomena and the relative processes and mechanisms that were responsible for degradation of MTBE. So that's kind of sexy and cutting edge, and hopefully we'll hear more about it in some of the follow-up seminars, but that illustrates some of the depth of understanding that you can get with stable isotope analyses. Let's go to slide 82. Let's talk a little bit about what it's going to cost you to do a CSIA study. Slide 83 is kind of gold-plated. This is what people would like to be able to do at most sites. There's a tendency to try to save money on this process. In my experience, it's probably short-sighted. But what I give you here is my recommendation for what you really ought to aim for to try to understand a single contaminant at a single full-scale plume. You start out looking at 4 to 6 wells to see if something's happening. That'd be a preliminary survey. And if you get evidence of fractionation in those wells, then you want to come back, and then that basically justifies spending the extra money to really understand how the whole thing works. And so a comprehensive survey on one particular plume is going to probably take you something in the neighborhood of 10 to 30 wells. And then I apportion that 10 to 30 wells into sampling, upgrading of the source to get a background, your source control, plumes along the center line, flow path, your plumes at the boundary, and then if you're lucky enough to have it, plumes in shallow, middle, and deep groundwater samples. Once you understand that plume, you probably want to come back a year later or 3 years later and resample it again to make sure it's behaving the same way. So when you're finally done, if it's a complex site, you're spending money for analysis of somewhere around 30 wells. Next slide. These analyses are not cheap if your standard is analysis of concentrations in groundwater. But that's really probably not the best way to think about it. The cost on this varies from vendor to vendor, and it varies on the number of samples that you provide, and it sometimes varies on whether you have matrix interferences and how complex your plume is, but it's going to cost in general somewhere between $200 and $400 to analyze one sample for one compound for one isotope ratio. The vendors will, because it saves them time analytically, will determine additional ratios or additional compounds on the same sample at somewhat lower cost. Now, that looks like that's expensive, but I would invite you to consider that you're doing it for different purposes. You're trying to understand how the contaminant is behaving from the CSIA analyses. Let's go to the next slide. Let's go to the next slide, slide 86. I do a lot of review of technology performance for the agency. And I see a lot of responsible parties spend a lot of money collecting monitoring data on site. And too often we're willing to spend the cost of 20 to 40 method 8260 analyses and roughly $100 each and still don't understand biodegradation, because all we know is concentration trends with time. Even a very few CSI analyses can go directly toward that question about whether biodegradation is occurring. So if the question is biodegradation managing the spread of my contaminant, then I would think it would make a lot of sense to invest in some carbon stable isotope analyses, because that will tell you, under good conditions, whether something's happening is useful or not useful. My experience that we collect a lot of method 8260 data because it's not really telling us what we want to know. Instead of collecting another type of data, we just collect more of the data that's not telling us what we want to know. So that's the reason that I'm spending time with you today to show you the advantages and power of this new method. Because if you use it intelligently, you're going to simplify my life as an EPA bureaucrat. Let's go to slide 87. I'm going to give you some contact information for people that provide these services commercially. I'm not allowed to comment on them other than I can say that I know these people and they've done nothing that has given me any reason to question their professional performance of the services. So you can buy these services from Microsieves. Next slide. From the University of Oklahoma. Slide 88, now go to slide 89. You can buy them from Zymax Forensics, or slide 91, you can buy them from the University of Toronto in Toronto, Ontario. So I am aware of and have seen data analyses performed by these four vendors, and quite frankly, none of them have ever disappointed me in providing data of adequate quality. So, At this point, we can open our webinar up to questions or comments.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm going to provide instructions for those of you on the telephone lines who would like to verbally ask a question. Again, I've globally muted all of the phone lines. So in order to speak with our instructor, you'll need to manually unmute your own line. Even if you've hit your own mute button, you want to hit the unmute and then hit #6 to take yourself off of mute to verbally ask a question on the phone. Again, #6, and feel free to speak up and directly ask a question. Go ahead. Okay. Those of you on the phone lines, if you want to continue to hang tight, again, we'll have time for Q&A with you. Again, it's #6. You can feel free to verbally speak up at any time. We do have a number of questions, though, that were submitted electronically online. I'm going to start to go through those in the meantime. If you are streaming the audio, you can continue to type up comments or questions now, and I will continue to read them to the instructor to answer. So go ahead and click that question mark button. Be sure your pop-up blockers are disabled so that a new window will open, and you can type your comment or question, and I'll read it off on your behalf. So if I don't hear anybody on the telephone lines right now, again, one last check. Anybody on the phones with a question?
I do have a question. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lazar-Kilconan from Canada, Alberta, Canada. I have a question in regards to, is any hypothesis on your part, John, as to why there is no degradation outside of the plume area?
For the particular case study that I presented, I think that the anaerobic bacteria that are degrading the MTBE are using hydrogen as a substrate. I think the hydrogen is produced by the fermentation of BTEX compounds in the plume. I think once the BTEX compounds are exhausted, then the anaerobic degradation of MTBE stops. And so what happens is, where you have enough BTEX to support anaerobic degradation, all of the MTBE is degraded. And there's a little bit of MTBE that's on the periphery of that active plume, and there's enough sulfate and oxygen and nitrate that you never have hydrogen. And so at the very periphery, you never start the anaerobic degradation. That MTBE escapes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hey, John. This is Yi from ZMS Forensic Textbook. Hello?
Yes, what's your question?
Yes. My question is on the slide 79. Slide 79. It's application for two-dimensional isotope forensics, carbon and hydrogen. In the table, I wonder if there's any typo. Is that epsilon carbon per mil and epsilon hydrogen per mil?
Yes.
Would that be hydrogen for the second?
We had some trouble putting my slides up. I can check that real quick and see what I originally sent.
But the second column, it says aerobic where oxygen is. For carbon, epsilon is minus 30. Is that very different from minus 2.4? I wonder if that's the hydrogen.
Yeah, it's the hydrogen.
Okay, so the second column should be hydrogen, right?
Second column should be the epsilon for hydrogen.
Okay.
I apologize for my typo.
Okay, that's what I thought. But, yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Again, anyone else on the phone lines with a question? I do see a number of online comments that we'll get to in just a minute. It's #6 if you'd like to ask a question directly by phone.
Yes, this is Vijaya with CH2M here. John, you used biochlor versus bioplume. Is there a reason why you picked biochlor model?
A bioplume is a two-dimensional fitted parameter model. It's harder to learn. It's more complex to implement. And my experience with regulators in the underground storage tank program is they're very rarely willing to use it. And they will use BioScreen. And so that was the reason, is I used the simplest model that I could get someone else to use. You could ask the same question and answer it very nicely with either BioPlume or any reactive transport model in ModFlow. So the short answer is, if you're a smart academic or a real good consultant, there's no reason why you should need to use our little wimpy simple screening model. You can use something more complex.
Thank you.
Again, any other comments or questions? Pound 6 on the phones. Okay, with that, I'm going to switch over to the streaming simulcast questions that have been submitted. Again, you can continue to type those up at any point, and we'll read them on your behalf. The first one came in early on in the presentation, and they ask, so the degradation is demonstrated by a C13-C12 value that is higher than the C13-C12 standard.
It's higher than the original condition. The standard is an arbitrary number that's used all across the world for standardizing the instrument. The comparison is not to the standard, but the comparison is to the ratio for that material that was spilled to the groundwater. And sometimes you can, if you don't have any degradation in the source, you can use the measured concentration in the field. But what most people like to do is use the measured concentration for that particular compound in commerce, before there was any chance for biodegradation in the groundwater. So your comparison is not to the standard, but to that compound that is as was originally released to the groundwater flow path.
And can I add to that? Am I live here?
Surely.
Yes, you are.
Okay. Then it would require that you had conducted the isotope analysis early on in the game.
Or if you're lucky and somebody's surveyed all the material in commerce for the world, and if you're lucky it's a fairly narrow range, you can just use the least negative value for what's in commerce. The EPA report that I referenced goes into some detail in that. There's
okay.
Several pages that talk about the trade-offs and the different approaches.
Very good. Thank you.
Great. The next question is referencing, this is coming from Denver, Colorado, and they're pointing to slide number 20. Again, we may be off by one or two, but this is in reference to, I believe they're talking about the numbers shown for stable carbon isotope ratios of MTBE in gasoline. And the question asks, what accounts in difference between standard and worldwide average of fresh, which is in quotations with question mark, gasoline samples? Why aren't they the same?
Those values are actually the values for carbon in petroleum. And the delta 13C for petroleum varies from one place to the other for a number of reasons. Largely due to the original delta 13C of the carbon that was deposited to become the petroleum. So what you're really seeing there is variation worldwide in the petroleum feedstock used to produce the MTBE.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Traverse City. And they ask, what are your general thoughts about using compound-specific isotope analysis for estimating the age of a release or identifying sources of contamination for commingled plumes?
I think you're more likely to have a useful result to separate sources of commingled plumes. I've never seen anybody make a convincing argument to me that you can use the delta 13C approach to age a release. That doesn't mean it can't be done, but nobody's convinced me yet. Probably two-thirds of the analyses that are done in North America are not really done to understand M&A, but are done for forensics purposes, are done to just as the caller from Traverse City identified, to try to see whose plume this particular groundwater contamination is. And hopefully that's going to be explored in much greater detail in the follow-up advanced course that we intend to offer on Wednesday, October 27th.
Excellent. The next question comes in from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I think you already addressed this in some of the final slides that you had gone through, but they specifically asked if you could provide a list of the labs, for example, their contact and location information that are conducting the CSIA analyses.
Okay. Well, yes, they are provided. That's not the only people in the world that do the analyses. Those just happen to the people that do most of it in North America and that I have personal experience with.
Great. The next question comes in from Concord, and they ask, can you comment on the applicability and usefulness of hydrogen and chlorine stable isotope analyses?
I think that in general they're useful if you're interested in the question of what is the precise mechanism. Now, you need to know the precise mechanism for some compounds to be able to pick the correct isotopic enrichment factor, epsilon. I think we're going to see them used more often in the future for chlorinated organic contaminants like TCE and PCE because they're a number of different mechanisms that can operate on those compounds, including biological reductive dechlorination as contrasted to abiotic transformation on iron minerals. And this two-dimensional and three-dimensional approach, I think, is going to be useful to separate out the true cause of the biodegradation. So this is something that's just now coming into the marketplace. It's been in the research literature for about 3 years. We're seeing more and more examples of it, but it was offered more as an opportunity than something that's really commonly done right now.
Thank you. The next question comes in from Raleigh, North Carolina, and they ask, how well does CSIA work to assess biodegradation of other BTEX compounds?
Not quite as well, because the fractionation factors are not as great. To the other extent, they're not quite as negative. But there are a number of reports in the literature where it has been used successfully for benzene and toluene. It works less well for the heavier compounds like the xylenes and naphthalene.
Okay, the next question comes in from Indianapolis, and they ask, have you expanded the application of the C13 isotope method to mass trend analysis?
Could you repeat the question?
They ask, have you expanded the application of the C13 isotope method to mass trend analysis?
I don't understand what a mass trend analysis. Whoever asked that question, if you want to get back on the web and expand your question, but right now I don't understand it, so I can't answer it.
Okay.
John, come back and look for your follow-up question.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then the next question I have that came in online is coming out of Washington State. And they ask, at chlorinated solvent sites, specifically TCE sites, have you observed conditions where you see little, if any, cis-1,2 DCE or vinyl chloride degradation products, yet CSIA indicates that you have significant biodegradation occurring?
We have a few sites that fall into that category, yes. We have more data where we've done microcosm studies, where we take sediments from those sites where it looked like cis had stalled and added compound of interest, never saw vinyl chloride or ethene or ethane or acetylene, and yet did get fractionation of the original compound. There are a few reports in the literature where people have seen that at field scale. And that's something that I would encourage people to look for more. I think that we're missing that, and I think that we're tending to misinterpret a lot of sites as being stalled at cis, when in fact the cis is being processed. It's just that we're not recognizing with 8260 type chemistry the degradation products that we expect to see. The non-biological transformation products are usually something like acetylene, which is further degraded. So it never shows up. I'm going to ask you to repeat that question to make sure I answered it.
Sure, no problem. Again, the question coming in from Washington was, at chlorinated solvent sites, and specifically TCE sites, Have you observed conditions where you see little, if any, CIS-123 DCE or vinyl chloride degradation products, yet the CSIA indicates that you do have significant biodegradation occurring?
Particularly if it's for the CSIA or TCE. Yeah, we see those sites.
Okay, I don't see any other questions that have submitted online. Again, if you are streaming the audio, there's still time. You can click that question mark icon and type up a further comment or question. Again, the individual from Indianapolis, if you'd like to further expand upon your question about mass trend analysis, please do so. Or you're welcome to contact either myself or the instructor directly to get an answer to your question. I'll switch back over to the phone lines and see if anybody on the phone lines has another question. Again, you can hit #6 and go ahead and ask the question directly, John.
Hi, John. It's Dan Lazorko Conan again. Just need some clarification in regards to the use of CSIR. Is it specifically for chlorinated solvents? I'm just looking through the EPA guidance document. It also mentions, and I think you had referenced some aromatic petroleum compounds in an earlier question or an earlier answer of yours. Where does it work best for? Is it the chlorinated solvents, or it says it's also applicable to the aromatic petroleum solvents and fuel oxygenates?
I think it works the best for MTBE and TCE.
Okay.
It's less well for benzene and toluene.
Okay.
And sometimes it works for CIS and sometimes it doesn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, if you're on the phone line, feel free, hit #6 and go ahead and ask the question directly. All right, again, do I hear someone else on the line?
Yeah, it is Huang Lin from Pennsylvania. My question is, when you use biological degradation in 70 feet, 1,000 feet, the migration pattern through so many forms of geoformation may be the living organism won't be able through so many different kinds of environment. So you have a lot of heterogeneity distribution. That is my concern. Yeah.
That's true. And that's why I answered the question about does it make sense to use a more sophisticated model? If you have the tools and training, obviously do that. The other side of that, to go with a more sophisticated model, you probably need better field data to calibrate it.
Another question is the heterogeneity of each side. The gathering, if we go through GC mass spec, is not only BTEX. It's 34, 35 peak of the organic compound.
Right.
So when we use this way, one factor is a nature geological factor questionable. Another one is the source of the homogeneity of the BTEX. You assume all the BTEX composition ratio between C13 and C12 is similar because of the manufacturer. Yeah. Which could be true. Okay. No question about it. But the source of each site, do you sampling the original site? Another difficult question to answer is even in the same storage tank, the suppliers of the refinery, different season, they may mix different chemical compound. Just try to meet the octane of the pump, the gasoline. So much more complicated than just the B very excellent, pure scientific assumption. Yeah. That is my comment. Yeah.
I'd like to comment on your comment, and everything that you've said is true.
Yeah.
If you'll look at our slide 28.
Okay.
Now, what obviously, what the speaker's talking about is most releases from underground storage tanks are not catastrophic releases. They're pinhole seeps. And so the release can occur over months to years before it's detected. And so what the release is a composite of material that was in that tank, the contents of a typical UST are turned over every week. And so if it's 2 years old, you probably have 50 different loads of gasoline that contribute to one particular release, and each load of gasoline will have a slightly different value for Delta 13C for a particular compound. So one way of dealing with that is to take the conservative approach of, well, I'm going to assume to start my comparisons that the Delta 13C is the least negative value that anybody's ever reported. In other words, I'm going to take the boundary. I'm not going to take the average condition.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the long way to go. Yeah. I think this method is a long way to go. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I appreciate everyone's comments. We do have a few more questions that came in online, and before I switch back over to those, again, anybody on the phone lines have a further comment or question, simply hit #6. Okay, in the meantime, I'm going to turn back to those online questions. And the first one that came in online comes from East Brunswick, New Jersey, and they're referencing a graph shown on slide number 21. Again, it may be off by one or two depending on which version of the slide you're looking at, but on the looks like, I believe, it's the x-axis has the fraction of MTBE remaining. And they ask, it's a nice graph of MTBE degradation, and they want to know if there's a similar graph for TCE, and if so, where can it be found?
It would be easy enough to construct one, but right now I can't think of, well, yes, I can think of it. If you will look in the EPA report, and in the section that where the equations are derived, it's the very back of it. There's a graph that shows the fractionation of TCE as it makes cis-TCE. And it has a similar relationship for TCE. There are also published papers that are referenced in that EPA report where experiments are organized that present the data in the same format, where it's the natural, if it's a fraction remaining or natural log concentration against Delta 13C. And those papers are referenced in the EPA report. Or you can send me an email and I'll attach some papers and send them back to you.
Thank you. And a reminder to the colleagues in New Jersey, that contact information can be found on the seminar homepage as well. The next question comes in from Princeton, New Jersey, and they ask, the case study cites two rounds of data and associated CFIA analysis to calculate defensible biodegradation rates. Is there a minimum number of rounds of sampling recommended to, quote-unquote, truth the CSI results, or could as few as one or two rounds be appropriate?
Practical reality is two rounds is about as much as anybody wants to pay for, so I don't think anybody knows an honest answer to that. So right now the state of practice is measure it and then come back some reasonable time later and verify it. If I ruled the world, this would be my little rule of thumb. I would characterize a site, and then I would look at the groundwater flow velocity and the concentrations and ask how long does it take water to move from the source to the well where the concentrations are approaching or have reached my standard. How long does that take? I would wait that amount of time, if it's reasonable, like, say, under 3 years, and come back and then sample a long enough time into the future so that the plume has had a chance to be totally recreated. If you come back too soon, what you're doing is really sampling the same object. So if you wait long enough, if your circumstance allows you to wait long enough so that the plume is pretty much reconstructed, and that reconstructed plume is attenuated, then simply a two-round of sample comparison has a lot of rigor and validity. But if you come back next week, no, it really doesn't. I wish I could say something more intelligent than what I just said, but that's the best I can offer.
That sounded pretty intelligent to me. Thanks, John. The next question is coming in from Atlanta, Georgia. And they ask, have you been able to determine that biodegradation exemplified by the C13-C12 ratio is typically supported by groundwater concentration trends?
The answer is the groundwater concentration trends usually, now let me back up. On the CurLab webpage, there's a little report on how to calculate rate constants for M&A. And that report distinguishes two different trends. If you take water samples from the same well over time and you fit a trend to the declining concentrations in a particular monitoring well over time, that is a measure of how rapidly the source is being weathered. That's not the rate of biodegradation. That's the rate of source attenuation. If you take a look at the trend in concentrations from one well to the next along a flow path, which is what I tried to do in the example, a well-to-well comparison, and you look at how long it takes water to travel from one well to the other, as I did in that example, then that gives you the estimate of attenuation in the water along the flow path, which is what you really need. And that's not a trend analysis. That's a well-to-well comparison analysis. So the trend analysis is answering a different question. It's an important question, but it's a different question.
Okay. The next question comes in from Concord, and they ask, are there any significant post-MTBE release or non-biological processes that can affect the carbon isotope ratios?
Could you read that again?
Are there any significant post-MTBE release non-biological processes that affect carbon isotope ratios?
Right. In the paper that I referenced by Tomas Kudor, one process that affects the ratio to some extent is phase transfer from water to air, and which is what you get when you do air stripping of the source. So if somebody's tried to do active treatment and hopefully succeeded to do active treatment of the MTBE by air sparging soil vacuum extraction, that treatment process can also change the isotopic ratio. And Cooter's paper will, you know, goes into some detail about how important it is and the trends where the ratios change. And to some extent we're fortunate because the trends go in different directions if you do two-dimensional isotopic ratios. The effect of volatilization affects hydrogen fractionation and carbon fractionation in different directions. And so you end up with your point being in different quadrants of the two-dimensional plot of delta 13C and delta D. But short answer is mass transfer from water to air has an appreciable effect. There's also minor effects caused by sorption and desorption to either organic matter or fuel. But that particular case is not something that's happening after the release. That's something that's concurrent with the release. So I hope I've answered that question.
Okay, thank you. Again, if there are any questions remaining from the online streaming audio participants, this is your chance to type them up and get them in quickly. Again, click on the question mark button. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up, and you'll be able to type up a comment or question. I'm going to switch back over to the telephone lines, and if anybody on the phone lines has another comment or question, it's #6, and then feel free to speak up.
Hi, John. It's Suzanne from Alberta, Canada, one last time here. You had mentioned that, just from following up my last question about which is most effective for the CSIR, you said MTBE and TCE. Their chemical formulas are so different. One's a chlorinated solvent and one's a fuel oxygenate. What makes them most, the most effective, to use CSIR on?
Right, those are the two most common materials. The characteristic of the material that makes it most effective is its molecular weight. The lighter it is, the more likely the fractionation is important. In fact, you can get phenomenal fractionation for carbon dichloride, methylene chloride, because it's a relatively light compound compared to TCE, and you can get phenomenal fractionation for methane, because it's light compared to MTBE or benzene. So the lighter the compound, the more the change is between one carbon 13 atom and one carbon 12 atom. The other thing is the epsilon itself, and that depends on the mechanism of action. Under some circumstances, reductive dechlorination can have a very strong epsilon. And under some circumstances, anaerobic degradation of MTBE has a very strong epsilon. Whereas other compounds, the value of epsilon is less negative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Again, if you're on the phone line, feel free to hit #6 and either make a comment or ask John a question. Go ahead.
John, I just have a comment. This is Yi from the Max Forensic Isotope. I would say for hydrocarbons, like a normal oil cans in crude oil, just like the new disaster in the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, the hydrocarbon, especially normal oil cans, for their carbon and hydrogen two-dimensional CSIA, would be very helpful for the salt identification and also the indicator or tracer for the oil itself during its weathering effect, and for, you know, in 3 or 5 years, everywhere you can find the oil spill, and you can figure out if that's the original, the New Horizon oil spill out from the other tankers. So carbon and hydrogen for the normal oil cans, since the product itself is a mixture of normal oil cans, it's already kind of a fingerprint, so making documents for the CSIA of oil samples would be very helpful for this kind of forensic projects. And this kind of work has been done within academic and also industry about 10, 15 years. So it's pretty well documented for the oil sample from the world, and it will be very helpful besides PCE, TCE, and MTBE compounds.
I'd like to tell you back what you just told me. the laboratories that developed this approach for our groundwater contaminants originally developed the analytical protocols and acquired the equipment to do two things. One is to determine the source material for petroleum reservoirs. And the other was exactly what you said, forensics of oil spills and surface water. So, you know, the BP spill in the Gulf is just one and another application of something that, you know, people have been doing, as you said, for at least 15 years, for spills all over the world. And certainly my point is that they know how to do it because that's where they learned how to do it, and then they applied that knowledge to our particular groundwater contaminants as a spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's any other questions on any matter?
Okay, I don't see anything else that's coming in online. I don't really hear any more beeps from anybody on the phone lines. So with that, John, would you like to make any closing comments?
Well, I appreciate the people that asked questions. They were excellent questions, and I hope that at least I started to give you the answer that's useful to you. So, again, I appreciate that you ask a question.
Great. Thank you. With that, I'm going to direct everybody to move along to the final slide in the presentation. It should be slide number 92, and we'll officially close the session out. Again, just a reminder that today's session is part one of this is a two-part seminar series, and it was a repeat of the one that was delivered on June 16th earlier this year. Those of you who are on the lines now, when you signed up for this session, you should have automatically been registered for part two of the seminar series, which is scheduled to take place on September 16th from 2 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So you should already have that participation information. If you don't, please take a look at the Clue-In training calendar or send an email to me, and I'll work with you to make sure you're signed up for part two. I did have some questions that came in asking about the advanced session or seminar that John mentioned earlier, and that was literally just scheduled and got on my planning calendar for later in October. I believe the date is October 27th. It's not open for you to sign up for just yet, but what we will do is be sure to send an email to all the registrants in this session to let you know as soon as the advanced seminar has been scheduled so that you can sign up to participate in that if you're interested. So I'm going to, again, direct everybody to move to slide number 92. And on slide 92, you'll find two very important links that I referenced earlier when we began the session today. The first is a link to the additional resources page, where on that page you can find not only today's PowerPoint presentation to download, but a number of other helpful references that were discussed during today's presentation, including the guide about CSIA, as well as a link to BioClore, to the model that was used that John referenced. The other link that you'll see on that final slide is a link to our feedback form. It does take just a minute or two to let us know what you thought of the delivery method as well as the content and the instructor. We do ask that you fill out that feedback form. If you have a need to have a confirmation message or something to retain to verify your participation today, when you fill out that feedback form, there's an option to have a confirmation message sent to you by email. If you are sitting at a location and are sharing the line with a number of other colleagues, you can also, as soon as you fill out feedback, there's a link once you submit the form to have somebody else fill out their own feedback form. And that way each person can actually check the box and have their own confirmation message sent to them. You can also go back to the seminar homepage that you were directed to when you registered and follow the link to the feedback form at the bottom of the seminar homepage as well. I just wanted to thank not only our instructor today, again, John T. Wilson from the EPA's CARE Environmental Research Center out in Ada, but I also wanted to thank all of the participants as well for joining us today. And again, as John mentioned, for asking questions and engaging in, a really great discussion about today's presentation. There will be part two, as I said, delivered next week on September 16th at 2 p.m., so you should have that information to participate. And I hope to hear or see from you all on the Clue-In Internet Seminar in the near future. So thank you again to our presenter. Thank you to all the participants. And this will be the formal closeout for today's Clue-In Internet Seminar. Thank you all, and have a great rest of your day.